Oh, the dictionary is very necessary. With the dictionary, you'll see. Yes, you'll really see that it's extraordinary. How the dictionary fills your vocabulary A to Z.
Dictionary, noun, a book or electronic resource that lists the words of a language, typically in alphabetical order, and gives their meaning. What is a dictionary and who uses them, who makes them? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. Today, we celebrate the joy of dictionaries with the help of UW Professor Emeritus Marshall Cook, author of numerous books and lover of words. Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I want to start with a project that we do together outside of radio shows like this one, Marshall, and that's the UW Odyssey Project, where you have been the vocabulary coach for 15 years.
And the comic relief.
This jumpstart course in the humanities for adults facing financial barriers to college. One of the things that happens in that course is that we give out a free dictionary the first night of class. Can you tell me why and what difference a dictionary can make in someone's life?
Oh, that's a powerful book. I've got a lot of things I'm trying to get done in my little segment, but I don't want people to be intimidated by words. I don't want them to be scared of words. I want to help them make words accessible to them. And that dictionary, I actually teach that's the fourth resort, you know, because you use context and you use word parts and you use sound and you do other things. But that dictionary will never let you down. And it's got the origin of words and you can see how they've changed meaning. And it's just such a rich resource. And I'm not one of these guys who insists that it be a book. You know, I'm glad they have the book to carry around, but if they want to go to dictionary.com or something like that, that's fine too. Yeah, yeah.
And what difference does it make once you recognize the richness of what's in a dictionary? You know, the numbers of words, the types of words. If you didn't know the scope of what's in a dictionary, what would you miss?
Oh, I think it would be overwhelming to confront a dictionary for the first time as an adult, having encountered life without it. You know, I take it for granted because there was always one in the house. And my mother, when I asked her a question, she'd always say, look it up in the dictionary. And I got in that good habit. She could spell, though. My mother was a great speller and crossword puzzle worker. But to encounter what's there, I mean, most of us, even in our work, in our day-to-day lives, we use just this fraction of the English language. And just to see its power and its scope and how many different ways you can say things and what a difference it makes and how your words can move other people and that you can be in charge of that. And the dictionary gives you all that. People who have to mine that the first time all by themselves amaze me because that's got to be very difficult. So, you know, we try to help them to know what they're looking at and what to look for. But I know we both emphasize this. By the time we get done with the year, I want them not to need me anymore. I want them to be able to do it on their own and to be confident. And if they ever, you know, if they got a question, they can certainly come to me. But I want them to have that power.
One of our UW Odyssey students, Tosumba Welch, wrote a piece when it was Valentine's Day, and they had to write a piece starting with the two words, I love, and it could be about anything. You know, I love pizza, I love my mother, whatever it was. But he wrote his on I love my Webster's, and we have Odyssey student Derek Allen reading this piece.
I love my Webster's by Tosumba Welch. I love my Webster's with a great passion and sense of dependency. Webster has never stood me up, let me down, or led me astray. Never. It tells me secrets that sometimes no one else can even imagine. One time I was walking through a path of words, and there were blank spots on the path. Out of nowhere, Webster replaced those blank spots with words, and I was able to continue my walk. Webster sat me down one night and gave me an idea that landed me second place in an essay contest answering the question, why vote? I have never known Webster to be anything but perfect. Webster has given me 230,000 reasons to be in love with it. I love my Webster.
If you knew Tusumba, you would be as surprised as we were that he would pick a dictionary to write a love song to. But he was sincere, and he really dove in.
And words are power. I think that's a key thing, too, that those 230,000 words in there, they can give you the power to write to a parole officer, to protest something, to figure out the legalese in a document, to crack open something that can seem somehow insurmountable.
Yeah, and it's one thing to say, I want my voice to be heard, but you also want your voice to be understandable to your listener and to move that listener in the ways that you want them to. So it's a power that you have to learn how to exercise, and you have to learn the tools, but it's mighty.
One of the essays that we read in the UW Odyssey Project is A Homemade Education by Malcolm X, and the passage where he writes about being in prison and encountering a dictionary has stayed with me in ways that make me never see a dictionary the same way again.
Me too.
And let's listen to, again, Derek Allen, a graduate of the UW Odyssey Project, reading excerpts from Malcolm X's piece, A Homemade Education.
It was because of my letter that I happened to stumble upon starting to acquire some kind of homemade education. Many who today hear me, somewhere in person or on television, or those who read something I've said, will think I went to school far beyond the eighth grade. The impression is due entirely to my prison studies. Every book I picked up had few sentences which didn't contain anywhere from one to nearly all of the words that might as well have been in Chinese. When I just skip those words, of course, I really end up with little idea of what the book said. So I had come to the North Fort Prison Colony, still going through only book reading motions. I saw that the best thing I could do was get hold of a dictionary, to study, to learn some words. I spent 2 days just riffling uncertainly through the dictionary pages. I never realized so many words existed. I didn't know which words I needed to learn. Finally, just to start some action, I began copying. In my slow, painstaking, ragged handwriting, I copied into my tablet everything printed on that first page, down to the punctuation marks. I believe it took me a day. Then, aloud, I read back to myself everything I had written on the tablet. Over and over, aloud to myself, I read my own handwriting. I woke up the next morning thinking about those words, immensely proud to realize that not only had I written so much at one time, but I had written words that I never knew were in the world. Moreover, with a little effort, I also could remember what many of these words meant. I reviewed the words whose meaning I didn't remember. Funny thing, for the dictionary first page, right now, the aardvark springs to my mind. The dictionary had a picture of it, a long tail, long ear, burrowy African mammal, which lived off termites, caught by the sticking out of its tongue as an anteater does for ants. I was so fascinated that I went on. I copied the dictionary's next page, and the same experience came when I studied that. With every succeeding page, I also learned of people and places and events from history. Actually, the dictionary is like a miniature encyclopedia. Finally, the dictionary A section had filled a whole tablet. I went on into the B's. That was the way I started copying what eventually became the entire dictionary. It went a lot faster after so much practice helped me to pick up handwriting speed. Between what I wrote in my tablet and writing letters during the rest of my time in prison, I guess I wrote a million words. I suppose it was inevitable that as my word base broadened, I could for the first time pick up a book and read and now begin to understand what the book was saying. Anyone who has read a great deal can imagine the new world that opened. Let me tell you something. From then until I left that prison, in every free moment I had, if I was not reading in the library, I was reading on my bunk. You couldn't have gotten me out of books with a wedge. Months passed without me even thinking about being in prison. In fact, up until then, I never had been so truly free in my life.
Any thoughts on that?
When
passage?
I first read that, and it's been quite a while now, but I was just stunned by that. The kind of fortitude, first of all, and dedication it took to do that. I mean, imagine, folks, we all use the dictionary, but nobody read. Well, I do. Sometimes I get caught up in it, but you don't read it word by word, line by line, and copy it out. And he literally taught himself the language that way. And I think that's astounding. And I'm glad that most people don't have to do it that way, that there's a lot of help available. But, man, I admired him for that.
And I like the idea of a dictionary being like a mini encyclopedia where each entry kind of has a story and introduces you to different ideas. Although it reminds me of an episode of the TV show Friends where Joey is feeling not educated enough and he wants to buy an encyclopedia but can't afford the whole thing. So he buys the letter V and then he studies all about Vesuvius and Vietnam and it brings Vietnam and the Vietnam War into conversation and the person he's talking to switches the conversation to the Korean War, and he's lost because he didn't buy the letter
that
K. Didn't buy that one. And I think, you know, a dictionary points to how much we don't know, how many gaps in our education there are, too, because you just can't possibly absorb everything that's in there.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about education. Every answer you get opens up 10 more questions, and you know, it's all in the quest, and the quest never ends. You know this, I'm sure, but a fellow spent a year reading the encyclopedia and wrote a book about that. And I wouldn't recommend that as a way of learning. But I had a thought about the dictionary as we were talking. This occurred to me rather late on in my teaching career, but you can't think it if you don't have words for it. So it's not just your ability to express yourself and to understand other people's writing that we're talking about. It's your ability to think thoughts. You know, we do that in words, and you have to have the words to have the thoughts.
Well, and having the right definition is crucial, too. One thing that I think some of the recent books that are out, like Word by Word by Corey Stamper, and then from some time ago, The Professor and the Madman, A Tale of Murder and Sanity in the Making of the Oxford English Dictionary, is that many of us don't think much about who it is that makes up these definitions in the dictionary, but they have a lot of power in some ways. Can you say something about the profession of lexicographers?
Yeah, the lexicographers are the people who write the dictionaries. And I read the book Word by Word by Corey Stamper and just loved it. And she's very open and honest about the travails of the job, but just things you never think about. I don't think we ever give a thought to who wrote the dictionary until there's something in there that we don't like. You know, a way a word is defined or the fact that the word is in there. You know, well, that shouldn't be in the language. And Corey Stamper lets us know after she goes through the whole process of what a word has to go through to get in there and what the work they have to do to get it right. She poses that question, you know, who decides? Who decides what a word means, how we're supposed to pronounce it, and whether or not it even belongs in the dictionary in the first place? You know, who let that word in? And she says, it's us. It's we the people. It's usage. I think of some recent words I've come across that were just recently made up. Hacktivist is one that comes to mind, mm-hmm. the meaning being obvious. There's all sorts of portmanteau words like that, scientific words, slang words. Well, the dictionary people don't really decide what counts and what doesn't. They chart usage. And that means they have to read an incredible amount and organize an incredible amount and sift and winnow, as the Wisconsin motto is, and decide how people are using it. And that's why a word that wasn't okay a couple decades ago now is okay, miraculously, or that new meaning of it is okay. It's because it has achieved the rank of common usage. And that's how people speak it.
Well, and she talks about how things have changed even by the time she got the book published, that it is such a moving target to try to look at how language is used. And certainly tweet would just have been a bird sound until yep. recently, and Google wouldn't have been in a dictionary. But we do tend to think of dictionaries as sort of authorities, that they, yes. they would have standard English and that tell you the way you should use language. And there's a lot of debate, it seems, as to whether a dictionary should be weighing in on the side of right usage or just putting how people actually speak.
Oh, absolutely. And when Noah Webster was putting together his first dictionary, it really did wield that kind of power because there weren't other sources. So if it was in there, it was real, and if it wasn't, it wasn't. And Webster was very aware of that, and he had to kind of play to his patrons, the people who were making it possible to have him write a dictionary and have it get published. So he had to take into account, you know, their proclivities and what they would agree to and what they wouldn't. So it worked both ways. There are people who had power over Webster, and Webster had a lot of power over us and what he let in. And it's hard to imagine back to when there weren't any dictionaries and there wasn't correct spelling. Mm-hmm. I use this example a lot, but in Shakespeare's day, you spelled a word any way it sounded to you. And there are, in his manuscripts, in his folios, examples of words spelled, you know, seven different ways mm-hmm. in the same play. And that was okay.
Well, and Jane Austen, in writing the late 1700s, she'll spell friend with an E-I rather than I-E and put in ain't and it's with the apostrophe not in the right place and things like that. And there weren't the same kind of strict rules about what a word could and could not be.
As long as the whole idea, and it still is does the other person understand? Mm-hmm. The trouble now is, since there is standard English and since there is accepted spelling, if we don't use it, we might be conveying the message that we're not very smart or that we don't know the language very well, and that destroys the credibility of what we're writing. So there is this standard, but Stamper makes this wonderful point that standard English isn't really the natural tongue of anybody. You know, nobody speaks that way, and a lot of it is based on Latin usage and outmoded rules and all kinds of things that don't make any sense anymore. But still, there are audiences for which you need to know exact standard English. But we all talk in we all do code switching. You know, we yeah. talk in different languages to different people.
And she raises the point in Word by Word that dialects are crucial to a language's survival and vitality, that having different kinds of modes of speaking keeps a language vital.
Yeah, and she raises a point that I had thought of subconsciously and it had bothered me, but I'd never seen it, you know, expressed so well before, and that is that there's a lot of moral thinking behind our judgments about dialect or about speech and writing in general. And she says, look, standard English is a dialect. Ebonics is a dialect. Folks from Carolina say things differently than we do. That's a dialect. Appalachia's got its dialect. And they're not morally bad. And they communicate among a group of people. And if you don't know it, you're the ignorant one. You know, you don't know what they're talking about.
I remember when Frederick Cassidy was still alive and working on the Dictionary yes. of American Regional English, I think he talked about 150 different ways to say dust bunnies under the bed, those balls yep. of dust, and depending on where in America you lived. So certainly capturing that kind of richness of regional speech is
yeah, and that goes beyond just the richness of the fact that we have so many words and so many choices to make, but just the way people use them. I've got an example on here, a dialect example. I don't know if I can get to it right away. I'll look up and see later. But, you know, people using nouns as verbs and just all kinds of things that we wouldn't consider perfectly regular to the people who speak that. When I was in California and my wife and I, when we first moved to Napa, we would just drive up into the hills and get lost, you know, and that would be the way we'd spend a day. And we came across the town of Boonville. And the people there, some of them still spoke Bootlink. And that was a language that this very isolated village had developed all by themselves, you know, without any input from the outside world. And some of the signs were still in that language. And, of course, nobody else in the world could understand it. Now there's a lot of movements to preserve languages that are being wiped off the face of the earth. I've got a Native American friend up north who's trying to save Ojibwe, and you know, recording it and writing it and teaching kids it. because they're precious things. And if they go out of existence and nobody's using them, they're gone.
And sometimes the thoughts behind a particular word are gone with it.
Yeah, and some things don't translate.
That's
you know, there are no other words to put it into. You really have to get into the culture to try to understand what they're saying.
More on dictionaries when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Oh, the dictionary is very necessary. Try the dictionary, you'll see. Any word that you can cook up, you can look up, pick the book up. The dick, 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 dictionary.
Yakko Warner sings all of the words in the English language.
Aardvark abating, a pet abdicating, a band and a bass and a breast. A blaze and ablution, abhor and abusion, abbreviate, abby obsessed. Abduct and ablation, abridge and abrasion, abash and abrupt and abride. Abscond and absentia, absent abstentia, abdomen ably abide. Abominable, abrogate, absolute, absent, absorbent, abstention, abstraction. Absurd and abundant, abusive, abutment, Acacia Academy action.
Dictionaries. We all use them, but do we really think about what it takes to put one together? I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marshall Cook, and we are talking about the joy of dictionaries. So what does it take to be a lexicographer?
I love Stamper's take on this because, first of all, she talks about what she was like as a kid, and she calls herself the nerdy girl. I don't think nerdy was in use then, but we know what that means. She was a word nerd, and she just, you know, got into books at a very young age. Her father came home from work one night when she was 9 years old, and she was reading a book, and he says, "What are you reading, kiddo?" And it was some sort of medical book, and she tosses out this medical term to him that she's reading about, and of course, he's never heard of it, neither had I when I encountered it, but she just loved words from the get-go. So she was a great candidate. The word she gives for that, there's a German word that more or less is pronounced Sprechgefühl, and it means an intuitive feeling for language, an intuitive love for language. And, you know, some people are just born with that, I think. And I think that was innate in her. She was very practical. Her parents were working class, you know, low middle class people. And she knew she had to work for a living, and she knew she had to be practical and make money. So she was thinking of becoming a doctor until she took organic chemistry, and that weeded her out of that field, as it has done many, I'm sure. But she wasn't going to just get a job where you sit around and read all the time, something like that. Although, she says, the thought of it made me turn to jelly. It was so good. You know, I mean, that's what she would have loved to do. And then she applied to be a lexicographer for Merriam-Webster, big-time stuff. And what she found out were only two requirements written down in the book, in the Merriam-Webster book, of what you needed to be a lexicographer. You had to have a college degree in any subject. Didn't matter. Could have been in economics, anything. And you had to be a Native American speaker, just so you'd have that feel for the language from the ground up. And that was it. And she says part of the reason for that is lexicographers have to be generalists. I mean, you may be tackling a medical term this week and something entirely different the next week, and you have to just be very flexible and able to pick things up quickly and to be very fluent, and it helps to be in love with the language. And she applied on all counts.
And she describes the working environment of being at a place where everyone is quiet and
yes.
looking into words. And
a lot of times they're reading or going through a file. They have to go through, they keep examples of word usage, and they have these boxes and boxes of examples of word usage, and someone has to go through and collate all them as to parts of speech and toss out ones that are, that seem like an anachronism or not right. And, you know, it's not fun stuff. But she says downstairs, where it's the publicity department and advertising and all of that, they're just joking and having a good time, you know, having a party down there. And upstairs, silence, because they're all at work. They're all being nerds.
I ran into a quotation by poet W.H. Auden about dictionaries, which said, "For a desert island, one would choose a good dictionary rather than the greatest literary masterpiece imaginable, for in relation to its readers, a dictionary is absolutely passive and may legitimately be read in an infinite number of ways." I found that very odd for a poet to be saying that if he was going to be on a desert island, you know, don't give me literature, give me the dictionary. But I suppose it's because you can do with those words what you want in multiple ways.
I think maybe the poet is assuming that he or she has a pad of paper or something so they can actually create with the words, because for me that would be very important. You know, the books would be great, but I'd be writing in the margins or something, because
I would think the personality of a lexicographer, though, would have to be someone who could survive breaking things into parts. And she does, Corey Stamper does describe it as being like a surgeon that is taking the language and cutting it into little pieces. And, you know, we know sometimes lexicographers or people who contribute to dictionaries can be insane, literally. As in one of the main contributors to the Oxford English Dictionary, there is something that seems like it would drive you insane if you were working on the 43 definitions of the word as or but or
the 465 different usages of the word run.
Yeah.
She talks about that in there and why it took 5 days just to sort through the examples and to put them into parts of speech. Yeah, I think being well on the right on the obsessive-compulsive scale would probably be a helpful trait.
And can you explain why it is that she says it's worse sometimes trying to define a short, what seems like easy word, why that is a harder task for a lexicographer to do something like runs as opposed to a great big highfalutin word?
It's because of the number of ways the meaning has branched out. I mean, there are so many different words, and you don't run a meeting the way you run a race, the way you run yourself ragged, the way you run up big numbers in a game. I mean, all of those things are the same word, but they're different. And they have different connotations, and it can be a very positive connotation or negative connotation. And they have to authenticate each one. And it is, you know, like a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, except for first you got to find the pieces. You know, they don't even give you a nice box with the pieces in it. You got to be collecting those over time.
She writes in one chapter of Word by Word about going to a meeting of other lexicographers, and they're more or less trading stories about how long it took them to do a particular word. And she writes, "We had the restaurant mostly to ourselves and talk turned shopwise. We discussed the differences between defining for the Oxford English Dictionary, which is a historical dictionary with over 600,000 senses, and defining for the Collegiate Dictionary, a relative lightweight at about 230,000 senses. While discussing this, I announced to the table that I had done the word take for the 11th Collegiate, and it had taken me about a month. One of the academics at the table shook his head. Wow. Peter piped up. I revised run, he said quietly, then smiled. It took me 9 months. The table burst forth in a chorus of Jesus is 9 months. But of course it did. In the OED, run has over 600 separate senses, making the Collegiate's take look like kid stuff. I lifted my glass of wine from the other end of the table. Here's to run, I said. May it never come up for revision again in our lifetimes."
Which, of course, it will.
It will, of course.
And you know, when you look at a dictionary now, think about that. Think about the person who spends 9 months running down one of those little words. And, you know, we all like to go home at the end of the day and feel that we've achieved something worthwhile, and to say, well, you know, I'm a little closer to getting one of the meanings of run today, but it's still eluding me. You know, that takes a lot of patience.
She makes the case that getting it right matters, that it's not just a kind of esoteric exercise that nobody cares about, that getting these precise definitions matters. How so?
Well, they certainly matter to people like you and me who write books, who read a lot of literature, who really care about the language. But in terms of communication, you have to have a good sense of what your audience that you're writing to, what they think a word means, and what is the accepted meaning. And a lot of times, allusions depend totally on, well, the person has to know this. You know, they have to know this story or it won't make any sense. And a lot of times, you know, a pun doesn't work unless you know what the right meaning of the word is and how I've cleverly, you know, twisted it to mean something else. And otherwise, you're not communicating. It's useless.
And it's amazing how just a switch of one little word can change the meaning profoundly. I remember it was a biography of Emily Dickinson that I published in Highlights for Children. And the draft that I saw, I had written Emily Dickinson did not want to live like other women of the 19th century. And the editor had changed it to could not live like, as if it was something
that
she couldn't do.
Huge difference.
Just changing one little word can make a difference. There was also the example she gives in Word by Word of President Clinton under deposition, saying it depends on what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah.
So certainly in legal context,
yeah,
that can come up in terms of what was meant by a word.
And legal writing is the way it is because it has to mean one and only one thing. The opposite of poetry, which, you know, gains great strength from being ambiguous and allowing people to play with it and possibly have different interpretations. And, you know, try that sometime. Try writing something so that it could have one and only one meaning. No one could mistake what you meant. Pretty hard.
Difficult to do. Now, you write detective books, I know, with your Monona Quinn series,
yeah,
and other books. There's a opening of one of Rex Stout's books, Gambit, where his hero, Nero Wolfe, is tearing out pages from Webster's Unabridged Third Edition and throwing them in the fire. He's disgusted with this unabridged dictionary and because it's not kind of taking a stand. Can you explain that? What does that show about someone if they're burning pages of a dictionary because it's too unabridged?
People care. You know, this is a book that evokes passions. Corey Stamper talks about getting death threats. The example that she used was, for years, obviously, the word marriage had been in the dictionary. When you revise the dictionary, you have to look for new ways it's being used. Maybe some old ways have fallen away and you have to get rid of them. And the determination to use the phrase gay marriage and to use that as a subset and define it, it was controversial to them. You know, they argued about that. They thought about that. And in the end, they decided, well, of course we have to use it. You know, it's in common usage. Somebody might not know what that refers to. Is that a marriage where people are really happy? So, of course, it has to be in there. But Stamper did literally get death threats about putting it in there. And the feeling was people said, well, you're saying that gay marriage is okay.
By putting a definition in,
sure,
you're tacitly
accepting. Now it's real. Now it's really something. Before it was in the dictionary, it wasn't anything. And the dictionary does wield that power whether it wants to or not.
She also talks about getting a complaint having to do with the definition of the word nude, which included the fact that it was without clothes. But then one of the definitions was that it showed pale white skin or pale skin of a white person.
Yes.
And this idea, is nude necessarily Caucasian? Just because you buy nude stockings, but if they're designed to match a white person's skin, is that assuming one standard? And so it got very complicated,
yeah,
political, racial. There are other words that she talks about where it certainly has to do with male-female relationships as well and who has mastery, so to speak,
of
the language.
Yes, it's fraught with emotion. That made me think of Johnson & Johnson's great mistake of selling flesh-colored Band-Aids. Mm. You know, well, what exactly is flesh color? And I don't think their Band-Aids ever matched anybody's flesh, but certainly not an African-American or a Native American. We just assume, flesh-colored. You can't assume.
So talking about a dictionary really touches on a whole lot of decisions any culture makes. It's much more complicated than just a list of words from A to Z.
Oh, and it tells you a lot about the culture. The fact that we have so many words for bodily functions, says some of which some people consider to be obscene, some of which some people consider to be ridiculous. You know, we all have opinions about them. And, of course, the great chestnut is that the Eskimos have, 432,000 words for snow. Well, they don't, as it turns out. But they have a lot of them, and that's because it is a huge part of their daily existence, and there are different kinds of snows. Before I moved to Wisconsin from California, friends, I had no idea. I didn't even know snow could be quiet, and just fall and be little tiny pellets or flakes or, there's a lot of different snows.
With the work of a dictionary writer, somebody who puts together the definitions, the etymology, the pronunciation, there's many parts that go in. So if you open up a dictionary to one particular word, can you just talk a little bit about the basics? What is it that we get from the dictionary that we should be paying attention to in terms of parts of speech, pronunciation, etymology, usage in a sentence, all those things?
And not only is it the practical stuff so we can use the word, but in the last decade and a half or so, I've become a complete word nerd, and I love to look up etymologies. I love to trace words back and see how crook got to come to be somebody bad who steals things.
How did it get that way?
It was a bend. It was like a bend in a river. And if you were bent, if you didn't walk the straight and narrow, you were a bad guy. You were a crook. Mm-hmm. But it took, a long time, long evolution for that. But you go back to the Roman roots, the Greek and Roman roots, and you find out how a word is migrated and evolved and sometimes now means the opposite of what it once meant.
Can you talk about eponyms, too? Because those are fun, like sideburns.
Yeah, I love eponyms. That's a word that takes its meaning from a person or sometimes a place. And it can be a fictional person or a real person. And sideburns were named for a general named Burnside, who had these ridiculous sideburns. I did that once. I grew sideburns all the way over and connected them to my mustache. My wife loved that. But that's where the word sideburn came from. The word sandwich came from the Earl of Sandwich. So many words. And I sometimes ask students, if your last name became an eponym, that word was synonymous with some trait. What trait would you hope it was?
Hopefully not one like Scrooge.
Scrooge, yeah. And we teach in Odyssey the Christmas Carol, and great example. Dickens did that a lot. He planted a lot of those.
More on dictionaries when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Zachary, Zanzibar, Zappian, Zamadar, Zillion, and Zip Code, and Zen. Zany, and Zoning, and Seal, and Zirconium, Zodiac, Zombie, Zayin. Zigging, and Zagging, and Zealous, and Zebra.
Accept this little book by Webster as a goodbye present from me. You won't have to look up deception. You're an expert at that, I can see. But if you're looking for sympathy, you'll find it in the dictionary just beyond. So long and sorry.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marshall Cook, and we are talking about the joy of dictionaries. Certainly is something exciting about going from A to Z and everything in between and trying to figure out what's in there and what we can do with it and who made it and what the political ramifications are of every decision that we see there. Can I ask you a personal question, which is why are you a logophile, a lover of words?
I'm not sure but that I was born that way. I know that I loved print before I could read. My mom says I used to go out on the lawn and sit and wait for the paper boy to deliver the paper, and I couldn't read yet, but I just sat there and held it, you know. And my grandfather was a huge influence on me, my mother's father. He was, through the Depression, and for his whole life, he was primarily a writer, and that's how he made his living. And sometimes when I would go stay with them, first of all, I noticed that he turned on classical music first thing in the morning and left it on all day. That was just the background. And then when he'd had his breakfast and talked with his dear bride, his bride of many decades, he would go to his den and he would start working. And it was okay if I wanted to come in and sit and watch him and just be in there and look at stuff. But I couldn't interrupt him because he was concentrating, typing on his old Underwood. And I just sat in there and looked around and realized, you know, the words were what mattered to him. Words were how he made his living. His words influenced other people. His words got talked about. And he was wearing his slippers and his bathrobe to work, you know, and he could go get a drink of water whenever he wanted to, and nobody came in and told him what to do. And that's when I started thinking, being a writer looks really good. But I think I wanted to be a writer before that. And it's funny because I wasn't an early reader. I kind of fought that. That took being sick in bed for 9 months when I was a kid. And there wasn't anything but the radio and comic books and the newspaper. And finally one day a friend of mine brought a book and said, would you like to borrow this? I just finished it. And it was a Hardy Boy book. And it just sucked me right in. And I read the whole thing. It was the first time I'd ever read a book all the way through. And he came the next day and he said, well, how are you liking it? And I said, I'm done. I thought it was great. He said, oh, you want another one? I said, there's another one? You know, somebody did more than one of these? I mean, I really didn't know about that whole world. And that's what got me started as a reader. And I think most writers start as readers. And the writers that I know best, and I know a lot of poets, they really have not just an abiding respect and almost reverence for the language, but what we would call, you know, heart love. They really love it. They love what it can do. They love to manipulate. They love the sound of words in their mouth. You know, that's where the poet really understands how important sound and rhythm and what words in conjunction do to each other, you know, in terms of meaning and feeling. That's the deeper richness of language beyond just knowing what they mean.
I think you talk about kind of experiencing language in the context of your grandfather or in a family setting. And I know in my case, we would play a dictionary game where you would open the dictionary and point your finger without looking, just point at whatever word it was, you had to ask the next person if they could define it.
And you know that game where three people have to bluff an answer, a definition to a word they don't know.
Yes.
And
yes.
The fourth person has the actual dictionary definition, and you have to guess which one is the right one. And the bluffing, I find, is wonderful. And a lot of people just have an inherent feel for sometimes what a word ought to mean, or they kind of know a root of the word, even if they don't know the concept of roots and Greek and Latin and all of that. And that can be fascinating. When I play that, I always go for laughs, so I never win. I want my definition to be the funniest.
I never win because I don't have a poker face. But
no, you don't. That is true.
So if you were going to encourage anyone listening who wants to instill a love of words in the next generation, you know, in children or grandchildren, and is thinking of introducing a dictionary or what you could do with a dictionary, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I'm seeing it in my little granddaughter now, who's six, and Boy, if she says, if she asks me, will you read this for me? You know, I'm putty in her hands anyway, but I just really melt when that happens because I love reading to her. And I think one thing is children, and there are lots of studies to bear this out, children who live in homes where there are books and magazines pick up language a lot faster than children who don't. Just have books around. Have them available. And, you know, don't force them ever on a kid. And don't be too worried if they're reading comic books or Mad Magazine, which was my reading of choice for a while. You know, the process of reading, you outgrow things, and then you look for better things, and better things, or at least more difficult things, more complex things. And once you get that notion of reading, the fascinating thing, I taught reading for several years, both to young kids and to adults in remediation. And the amazing thing is we understand how all the synapses close in the brain and all of that, but we don't know what causes that aha when kids get the concept or when an adult gets the concept. Oh, this means that. And you put that together and that means that. Oh, this tells a story. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. And it happens all at once for most of us. I don't think very many of us remember the moment when we really learned what reading was, but it just, aha, it's the greatest aha that there mm-hmm. is. And I had the privilege of seeing adults get it who had never been exposed to that before. So I would keep books around, I would keep magazines around, and it helps if they see you reading.
I would also think it would help to see you looking up things. In other
yes.
words, having a dictionary or access to dictionary stuff right on a phone. But this notion that, oh, I see this new animal or I hear this new term and now I can look it up and find something more about it, you know, that just to model the fact that you don't have to know it all, that there are these reference works.
Oh, that's such a good point. I think some of the most important words a teacher ever can utter is, I don't know. Let's mm-hmm. let's find out. Let's find that. And you go on the exploration with the child or with the adult, whoever it is, and you learn it. And fortunately, I don't have to fake that. You know, that happens often enough.
I also remember with my children making up our own dictionary where we would have an A page, and on that A page might be the name of a pet that we had starting with A, or an aquarium if we had
an
aquarium.
What a great
idea.
But
you just look around and make the dictionary filled with the things that are right there in front of you. And so just the process then when you're out and about in the grocery store and you see an eggplant and you think, oh, let's put that on our E page. But I think just involving children in the construction of a dictionary and looking at how everything you see belongs somewhere in the alphabet.
Yeah, yeah. You know. And how you keep adding to it and your vocabulary keeps growing.
I think I would be hard-pressed to be a good lexicographer, though, because I would be inclined to add judgment to definitions of certain terms.
Yeah.
I think it would be hard to stay detached. For example, just the way we have connotations that are so different for bachelor versus old maid,
yes.
You know, or just things where it would be hard not to be political in one's response. So the lexicographers must have to kind of really almost stifle their own biases.
My undergraduate training was as a journalist. And of course, the rubric was you will be objective. Well, no one is objective. It's like creative writing teachers telling their students, now, when you revise, you have to come back to your work objectively. Well, of course you don't. You don't come back to your baby objectively. You know, this is yours. Mm-hmm. It's your heart. But you have to be able to look at it and criticize it and try to improve it, just as you do a child whom you love to bits. And, you know, that you don't feel the same way about anybody else's kid as you do about your own kid somehow. Or if you do, I think you're probably on your way to sainthood. But most of us don't. I don't think we can ever be objective, and we shouldn't try. That can be soul-deadening. But we should be fair. Judges have to do that. You know, I'm sure they have feelings about the people that they have to pass judgment on, but they have to look at the law and what they actually did and what the evidence suggests. And you can do that, but it's a strenuous discipline. It's not natural to me.
She had, in Word by Word, Corey Stamper has an entire chapter called Bitch.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah, yeah. Another one of those ones that I don't know if she got death threats about that, but people were very lathered about that. And, of course, originally, when Noah Webster was making the first American dictionary, bitch meant a female animal. And people raised dogs. They had hounds for hunting. You know, the gentry, the upper class, was quite familiar with the word bitch. And bitch in heat, you know, was not a derogatory term. That was, hey, my dog's in heat now. You know, now's mm-hmm. the time to mate her. But then it began to get this, you know, well, a bitch in heat, that's a loose moral woman is what that is. I mean, it took a long time, but the meaning began to come to that. And Webster wouldn't put that in his dictionary because the gentry wouldn't like that at all. But people were using it that way. So ultimately it that actually became, I think, the most common usage of bitch. And it is very negative, and it's a word that I would not use in speaking to or about a woman. But it started out, it was absolutely, in terms of connotation, it was neutral.
And she talks in general about dialects, too, and how it was hard even with her own daughter
yes.
to have dialect used in a different way.
Do you want to hear that?
Sure.
As staunch a defender of dialect as I am, this is Stamper now, I fall into the same trap that all of us do. I consider myself the center of the lexical universe. The difference is that I should know better. My younger daughter has spent her formative years in the mid-Atlantic region of America, which means that she and I speak different dialects. You would think that this would be a source of wonder to me daily, but it started out as a source of utter frustration. One day she came home from school, and I wandered out of my office to chat with her. Do you have any homework? I asked. No, I'm done my homework. This particular construction is a marker of the local dialect and also happens to be a marker of Canadian English. It's usually used with the participles done, as above, and finished. I'm finished my burger. Though I also hear it with the participle going. I'm going Emily's house. These are all completely normal sentences around here. And in my town, this construction is used by people of all socioeconomic levels, from doctors to panhandlers. It is wholly unremarkable. Except it was wholly remarkable to me. No, I corrected her. You're done with your homework. Right, she answered. I'm done my homework. All my years of training, all those hours spent carefully crafting responses to people who complained about the dialectical ain't or irregardless, and she defends that word, by the way, were thoroughly defenestrated, thrown out the window. What motivated me was fear of judgment. I'm done my homework is not a part of standard English, and my beautiful little girl was going to be judged on the basis of her abilities with standard English, and I didn't want anyone to think she wasn't smart because she says, I'm done my homework. Never mind that just about everyone who spent their formative linguistic years here says that. Never mind that she will eventually learn that I'm done my homework is not standard English. And she will, like the rest of us, learn to switch between her native dialect and her prestige dialect. Never mind that my own dialect is wrong here. Maternal worry surfaced in dialect shaming. That's a concept I'd never encountered, but it is so true.
Dialect shaming. Well, I'm done my radio show. And I thank you for being a guest and helping to celebrate dictionaries.
I'm right pleasurable to be here.
My guest has been Marshall Cook. I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
You'll find it in the dictionary just beyond. So long.